Chapter 1 A tide of grimy water sloshed from a curbside puddle onto the pavement as the black-and-white minicab slowed to a halt in front of the equally grimy old-time theatre. Inside the taxi, amidst the pattering of rain on the roof and monotonous whir of wiper motors, the driver glanced furtively at his passenger in his rear-view mirror. She looked every inch the glamorous celebrity in her dark glasses, bright red hair, and fur coat. Despite the no-smoking sign, she sucked away at a cigarette on the end of a long black holder, her sharp cheekbones looking even more jagged every time she inhaled. He had considered asking her to put it out, but lost his nerve at the last minute, remembering her headline-grabbing reputation for confrontation and public outbursts of physical violence over the years. The smoke, together with the condensation forming on his mirror, made her look vague, blurred, like a photograph taken with a filtered lens, just as she had appeared on the telly, in fact. He craned his neck around to talk to her, and the illusion shattered. This was a woman who looked attractive from afar. Close up, he could see the heavy frown marks, the deeply etched misery lines around the mouth, still canyon-like underneath the layers of powder. Here was a woman who did not laugh very often, he thought. But wasn't there some rumour about radical plastic surgery a few years ago? What was it? He gave up trying to recollect. Whatever it was, it hadn't been radical enough. From the voluminous carpet-bag at her side, another equally ancient and cadaverous head reared up and peered myopically through bulbous, teary eyes at the driver. Part trembling poodle, part budgie fetus, he surmised, it sniffled and wheezed asthmatically, before curling up again inside the bag when he spoke. "We're here," he said. His passenger didn't reply. As far as he could discern, she seemed to be staring out at the grey stone exterior of the theatre. Embarrassed by the silence, the driver made a stumbling effort at conversation.
"When you going back into Winkle?"
he asked amiably. The response, a derisory snort, made him turn around quickly and stare nervously ahead.
"When hell freezes over."
The voice was husky and deep, so deep it was almost masculine. She stubbed her cigarette out aggressively against the window, dropped it on the floor, and peered behind her at the passing traffic.
"Drive on," she commanded. "Where to?" "Around the block. Anywhere. Then back here."
She seemed tense, uncomfortable. The cabbie shrugged nonchalantly, put the car into gear, and slipped into the slow-moving stream of traffic again. If the lady wanted to throw her cash around, it was fine by him. Christmas was only 3 weeks away. He needed the money. He smiled at her in his rear-view mirror, just to put her at her ease, but her features remained frozen behind the sunglasses, and he was left feeling foolish. He'd had one or two famous people in the back of his taxi over the years, a loud-mouthed lass from Big Brother, Tony Bennett's second cousin, and an ex-boxer who'd been on the receiving end of a good thumping from Michael Caine in Get Carter. They'd all been quite pleasant and chatty. This woman was a star of a different sort, a frightening, all-consuming, charmless thing that sucked in light and energy and goodness and gave nothing back. A human black hole, mused the taxi driver. The black hole lit up another cigarette and blew smoke into the front cabin. Wispy fingers of nicotine and tar curled around his throat, waking him from his disturbed thoughts. He indicated left, turned the corner, put his foot down and was back in front of the theatre in no time at all.
"Were we followed?"
she asked.
"I don't think so,"
replied the cabby. The actress nodded, relieved. A small crowd of pensioners in plastic rain-hats and see-through raincoats had now gathered under the theatre portico. This seemed to please the black hole. The red gash of her lips settled in a grim travesty of a smile. She leaned forward towards the driver.
"How much?"
"That's £10, please."
Heavily painted eyebrows shot up above the rim of her sunglasses and hovered there like big black-rearing caterpillars.
"A tenner for a few paltry miles? You are shitting me."
The driver felt his testicles retract inside the safety of his pelvis. He stuttered a reply.
"That's what it says on the meter."
She exhaled and snorted indignantly. Scrawny talons grabbed at a large leather handbag, more weapon than fashion accessory, took out a £5 note and waved it at him.
"Call it a favour, and I'll throw in a signed photo."
Weak in the presence of ego, the cabby could only nod. The deal done, she alighted from the taxi in front of the gathered crowd. As he pulled away, he heard the loud gasps and cries of "We love you!" as an appreciative horde took in the sight of its favourite bona fide ex-soap star. He continued to stare at her through his rear-view mirror, standing there in front of her fans, arms outstretched in a voluminous fur coat. As he stared, it seemed to him that the further away he drove, the larger her image seemed to loom until it filled his mirror. Unsettled, he blinked rapidly until normal vision resumed. The black hole receded. He turned the corner and she was gone. Later on, he would remember that moment, and watching the news with his wife, he would say,
"I had a premonition about this. I did. I saw it coming."
On the pavement outside the Old Tyne Theatre, Corinna Hemsley, former leading actress of soap opera Winkle Bay, Miss Crumpet 1977, winner of 7 Soap Star of the Year awards, patron of the Rolf Harris Donkey Sanctuary, and the distinguished recipient of the Domestos Lifetime Achievement Award for services to popular drama, stood in God's spotlight, basking in the cold warmth of a dreary winter sun and the adoration of her fans. She grinned and paraded like a performing chimp, posed for photos, rolled her eyes good-humouredly when the crowd called her Cora.
She knew better than to correct them, for what was the point? Some of them were on prescription drugs. Most of them had lost a serious amount of brain cells. She would always be Cora Smart, strong-willed mother and chief executive of Smart Fish PLC, the best fish gutters and kipper smokers in Northumberland. She was Cora first and Corinna second.
"Are you coming to see the show?" she asked.
A universal yes went up. A large woman advanced and put an arm around Corinna's shoulder.
"When you're going back to Winkle Bay, Cora, we miss you."
The woman buried her head in Cora's neck. Corinna, overwhelmed by the stench of wet wool and urine, struggled to overcome the urge to vomit. In an impressive display of her acting talents, she hugged the fan, stroked her head, kissed her brow, stunning the overwhelmed woman and rendering her so useless that when she was propelled back into the crowd by a well-placed shove to the spine from the soap star's bony hand, she barely noticed.
"Ah, bless you, my love," Corinna crooned. "God bless you. Never say never, as the saying goes, but you mustn't hold your breath, sweetheart."
An old man elbowed his way to the front, knocking several of his less than nimble friends off balance. He took her other hand and brushed his cheek with it.
"It's not the same without you, Cora."
Carina pouted and air-kissed him.
"No, it's not, is it?" she said, tucking her chin into her scarf to hide her unprofessional smirk.
She managed to convert the evil cackle which started in the back of her throat into a delicate cough.
"We've worked it out," he continued. "You're only in the Farne Island Psychiatric Hospital. You could easily escape and jump on a boat back to Winkle Bay."
Carina closed her eyes emphatically and shook her head. A portentous silence befell her audience. She had something important to say.
"The thing is," she breathed, "I'm not sure I want to go back."
A gasp of shock went up from the crowd.
"Don't get me wrong," she said hurriedly. "It's still a great show. Oh, I don't watch it all the time. I can't. I'm a busy actress. But I look in on it now and again, because I like to see what my good friends are up to. After 5 years of being away, I still miss my on-screen family. I love them. They're a part of my soul."
The crowd approved.
"The twins need you," gushed one lady. "They're not conjoined any more. They had an operation in Brazil. Abel Fennett did a sponsored row round Holy Island to raise the money."
Another woman nodded.
"And he's only got one arm. He went round in circles most of the time,"
chipped in her friend.
"Oh, it was upsetting."
Carina took off her sunglasses and tapped them across the palm of her hand, waiting for the focus of attention to return to her.
"I have to say," she said, as her audience calmed down, their memories of Abel Fenwick's heroism abating, "from the little I've watched, things aren't what they were. And the proof of the pudding is in the viewing figures, isn't it? The viewing figures say it all. Now,"
and she paused again before uttering three powerful words,
"my last episode."
A reverent murmur echoed around the theatre entrance.
"When I had my nervous breakdown. Remember?"
"Best nervous breakdown in a soap award, 2003,
interjected a voice at the back.
"As well as best dramatic exit that same year," piped up another voice.
Carina acknowledged another round of applause with a smile and a modest shake of her head.
"Bless your kind hearts,"
she said with a quivering lip.
"Anyway, so you'll remember it well, how I tried to blow up the kipper curing shed. Do you know how many people were watching?"
Looks of consternation were exchanged. The crowd wasn't sure. But before Carina had chance to enlighten them, a reedy girl-boy voice called out from somewhere in the crowd,
3.75 million.
An appreciative gasp went up. Everyone turned to stare, including Carina, knocked at having the limelight stolen away. The new focus of attention, a large man in a baseball cap and green army surplus parka, younger by about 30 years than the other fans nearby, faded back into the shadows of the theatre entrance. He gazed down shyly at the ground, his features hidden behind the brim of his cap and a beard of several days' growth.
"Yes!"
Carina exclaimed, clapping her hands.
"Well done! Nearly 4 million!"
The sunglasses went on again, and she nodded triumphantly.
4 million people watching me!"
She waved her hand away modestly at the round of applause.
3.75 million, repeated the bearded man. That's not taken into account.
Yes, thank you, interrupted Corina, irritated. She had moved on. There was another point to make.
How many people watched the Christmas special last year when the lighthouse fell on Ezekiel Smart Jr.?
The old man with the sharp elbows turned around, wondering if the clever young lad in the anorak knew, but he was nowhere to be seen. Corina took in the gormless expressions around her.
2 million,
she said slowly, emphatically. A weak voice piped up.
There's too much sex in it nowadays.
No, there's not,
said another, but they all agreed that it wasn't the same. Corina grinned, then tucking in her chin again and affecting a wide-eyed Diana Princess of the People pose, said,
Rufus Frenkel, the producer, the man who calls the shots, the head honcho, the Judas.
The very mention of the man who had ended her career so heartlessly and so quickly made the bile rise in her throat. She swallowed, forcing back the bitterness. Her serene smile returned.
If you don't like what he's doing with the show, write to him. Tell him. Tell him what you've said to me. Winkle Bay is yours. It belongs to the people.
The applause pleased her. Corina looked up sharply as the familiar odour of Lily of the Valley and dirty underwear wafted back. The smelly woman was at her side again.
They should never have sacked you.
Corina's eyebrows became inverted. I wasn't sacked, she hissed through gritted teeth.
I resigned.
But the woman was either too stupid or too short-sighted to see the pursed lips and raised eyebrows to realize that this was not a healthy subject to pursue.
They got rid of you after you had that facelift, didn't they? That's what the paper said. You went all bloated, and they put that photo of you next to the one of a baboon's boom.
Corina shook her head furiously.
It was an allergic reaction to pineapple.
But her explanation went unheard. They had stopped listening. The celebrity paradox had kicked in again. 25 years of fame and of meeting her people had taught her a thing or two about fan behaviour. It went through 3 distinct phases. The first, the thrilled phase, involved hysteria. The fans just couldn't quite believe they were actually talking to her and that she was real. Result, temporary paralysis of the senses. They could barely string a sentence together. The second stage, which consisted of excitement and inquisitiveness, was the adoration phase. Result, gushing conversation and sycophancy. It was her favourite phase. Corina had called the third part the rude bastard phase, because after a while fans forgot that they were in the presence of a real person, a mortal creature. They would revert to habit of criticising, grumbling in front of her, as they would when sitting in front of the telly at home.
"Isn't her dress awful? She looks thinner on telly," etc.
Usually Corina didn't mind the comments. She was a celebrity, she was famous, she was rich. Being talked about meant you'd arrived. Well, that's how she'd felt when she'd been in long-term employment. This time the comment struck home.
She's got a bit of a turkey neck going on. Is it a wig? Somebody like her should be in panto at the Theatre Royal. What's she doing in this dive?
Corina inhaled and drew herself up to her full height. Pulling her collar around her neck protectively, she managed a curt, "Enjoy the show," before disappearing down the side alleyway and crashing through the stage door entrance in a foul temper. Inside the building, Irene, on stage door sentry duty, waved at her tentatively as she swept by, muttering something that sounded very much like "Senile old fuckers," under her breath. End of chapter 1.